Hey there, welcome to Journeys of Empowerment, the podcast that's on a mission to spark agency in each and every one of us. I'm your host, Michiel Soetjiet-Rijt, and in this show, we'll be diving into real-life stories, personal challenges, and incredible transformations with inspiring role models for social impact. Whether you're navigating on your own journey or helping others on theirs, this space is for you. But before we dive in, I'd like to take a moment to thank our first sponsor, Neotopia, for believing in our mission. Neotopia empowers leaders, both formal and informal, to influence positive behavior change through proven organizational behavior management. Their training and coaching help teams create lasting culture shifts and drive performance with positive reinforcement. For more info, check them out at neotopia.nl. Hey, hey, I am excited to welcome Farzan Najmuddin, founder of Insight People and Culture, a visionary human-centered leadership development. Farzan's journey, shaped by a unique background, upbringing, and personal challenges, has guided him toward his mission to transform leadership in today's world. Through his AI-powered, hyper-personalized platform, he empowers first-time and mid-level managers, integrating leadership growth directly into everyday work. Grounded in positive psychology, neuroscience, and behavioral science, Farzan's work fosters authentic connections, emotional agility, and inclusivity. Join us as we dive into how his story and insights are shaping a future where leaders drive engagement and create cultures where everyone has the space to thrive. All right. Here we are. Sorry. Hi, Farzan.
Hey, Michiel.
Welcome. Oh. Hey, let's start by the beginning. How did we meet? What was our starting point? Maybe let's start. I always have to laugh if I see your face.
Thank you.
This isn't funny for the listeners, yeah. So sorry, but yeah. Okay.
No, it's interesting that you asked me that during a podcast, because as you know, I got to know you through a podcast. I think it was with Johan de Wit on SaaSbazen. And then I was actually listening to it to get some tips, listening to more of his podcast to get some tips as a SaaS founder. And then your podcast was like about everything besides SaaS. Hey, this dude sounds interesting. No, but what I really liked about it was the authentic part of you telling your story in a vulnerable way, but kind of owning it, you know, be like, hey, this is what happened to me, this is where I'm coming from, and I want to share my message to inspire other people to be able to do the same and to know that, hey, you're not alone and we're all going through stuff and that's also okay. And to kind of incorporate that into a SaaS story, I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me send this dude a message.
Yeah. And were you already then at that moment in the middle of the process of starting your own SaaS company, or was it even before that?
I think we were just starting.
You were just starting. Ah, okay. So that was the specific reason why listening to the SaaS Basis podcast of Johan. And then, okay.
Yeah. And then you came along.
Yeah. And interesting also is the way you approached me, because that is typically the way. If you want to meet somebody, or maybe you can say it in your words, but that makes you you.
Oh, what about it?
No, there was something in you that said, okay, I need to know to get to know this guy. Who is this? That's typical you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's also the way to make a jump to Insight, your company, together with us co-founder, with Casper, that the URL, the story about the URL, that was also a funny story, but it's similar, the outreach, is it a similar way? Maybe to start with, how did you get the URL of Insight?
Yeah, there was also, we just reached out to the owner of it. It was a company that I think the man retired, and I think he got already a lot of approaches from bigger corporates. But it was just a man who was also, emotionally attached and cared much more about the impact of stuff you did than just monetary value. And then when we had a like true conversation, I was just honest. I'm like, hey, I'm a starting founder. I don't have the budget like this and this. But however, I can like, you know, like give you a certain amount of money. And at the same time, you know, like, I don't know, like, let's find something creative. And then we talked, and then the end, I was like, hey, I studied at a Thai cooking school for a few months to know how to make Thai curry from scratch. Perhaps that's something I can offer you. And I think he thought after a while, okay, this dude is really not bargaining. This is like really whatever he has. And I think he really liked the mission we had and the kind of conversations we had, which was like super honest, super transparent, that in the end he was like, you know what, let's go with you guys.
And that's how I get to know you too. It's not about the selling, or it's not about convincing somebody, but it's about starting a human connection and see from there what can come out of it, right?
100%.
Without any expectations up front. So that's beautiful. It says a lot about you as a person and how you perceive life and approach life. And do we say still inside people and culture, or are we going to use the different?
Very recently we started the rebranding. Soon we will launch it like publicly, but the new rebranding is teamhuman.ai.
Wow, what a name, teamhuman.ai.
Yeah.
It's already yours, right? So we can, safely speak about it. Okay. Yeah. Wow, and what are you trying to achieve?
So with Team Human, we are trying to achieve something that is very strong to what I've been doing my whole life, I think. It's about helping people, like having impact at a place that I felt that is still underdeveloped in that sense, because you have a lot of leadership development. There's obviously very good coaches, don't get me wrong. Like, there's amazing good coaches, there's good trainers. However, if you look at companies and where a big problem lies is the way we look at management, because people get promoted into a management position because that's the only way to go up, which is a ridiculous way to think about management. So just imagine this scenario: you're very good at sales, and then because of your high performance, you get promoted. You're a first-time leader. You're standing there. Suddenly, you're... senior management is telling you, hey, more revenue, we want this and we want that, while your direct report is saying, hey, I want to be valued, be seen, be heard, and you're just standing in the middle. You're like, what am I doing here? I was just good at sales. And that's something we saw a lot. And good coaches usually don't go there because companies don't have the budget for that. Training programs can be very impactful, but the learning curve is super low, super high, as in like people forget about it within 4 weeks on average, like 89%. And then you have e-learning, but yeah, just mention one person, you know, that is like excited about traditional ways of e-learning. It doesn't work. So what we thought is, hey, how can we kind of bring the quality of like good coaches that can be able to comprehend everything that's going on? What type of culture are you in? What type of context is it? What type of team are you leading? What type of personality do you have? What type of competency frameworks does this company have? Like, what is expected from you? What behavior is expected from the certain values? That's usually what good coaches can do. They can see all these things and then be like, hey, Michiel, this is how you can, you know, like be a better leader. So we thought about that. And with Insight, we actually wanted to do something bigger, but then we also realized by working a lot with companies, getting a lot of feedback, a lot bigger pilot studies, we actually found out, okay, it's better to do one thing really good instead of trying to do a lot of things. So what we are focusing on now is to go to the most impactful moment. Because if you think about skills like empathy, skills like conflict management, all these things, usually where do they manifest? It's in communication. Mm. So sometimes people say, yeah, I go to a communication course. I always think, like, what does it mean? Like, it's just a tip of the iceberg communication. Beneath the tip of the iceberg communication lies all these people-centered skills. So that's what we thought, okay, what if we can use AI to truly listen to the important one-on-one conversations during the one-on-one conversation, obviously, like, the ones you want him to join. Then during this conversation, it actually analyzes everything you say, and based on your personality, like the type of skills you have, based on the values of your company, because like leadership can be very different companies, based on the competency frameworks, based on the feedback anonymously you get from the team. Hey, what's playing in this team? based on all these things, our AI is actually super well trained to be like, hey, Michiel, you know that psychological safety is a theme in your team. And during your conversation, you were actually speaking for a pretty long time. Next time, perhaps try to reduce your speaking time. And these are questions you could ask. These are actually the moment he or she responded this, you could have actually asked this and this as a follow-up question. So basically, you will be trained on the job. And that's what we hear a lot from the market is people are saying, we don't have any on-the-job training that is very sustainable for the younger managers. And that's what we do. So that's Team Human. And in the end, it's not any kind of training. That's why it's also called Team Human. We really believe in, because there's a lot of ways of leadership, we really believe in the human-centered approach that in the end, in the future, the only reason we actually need managers, they will, like all the other things, I think will be automated, what they're doing. The most important thing are the human-centered skills of building connection, making people feel seen, making people feel heard. That doesn't mean that they will not be able to set boundaries. That's part of it, setting healthy boundaries. But at the same time, to be able to create this authentic human connection, that's what we all crave. And yeah, that's what Team Human is about.
Beautiful. And you mentioned not a budget. There's a budget component in it, training and budget. Or is it more a lack of sense of urgency? Do we understand the challenge or maybe even the problem you are trying to solve? Do we understand that?
I think that's a very good question. I think it depends on what company you ask. So if you look at the research, yes, we do. All the research, whether you go from Gallup to McKinsey, Deloitte, all these bigger companies, they've done research and they've shown that one of the biggest obstacles in engagement, in the feeling of retention, all these things is the direct manager. But then at the same time, for example, they've done research. It was a German study that said, out of my head, don't hold me accountable for the exact numbers, but it was asking managers, how many of you do you think you're a good leader? 96% said, I am a good leader. But then they asked direct reports, how many of you had a bad leader? I think it was about 75% that said, I have a bad. So you see that there's a huge gap in between those perceptions. So the research is there, the awareness is there. Some companies we speak to are also completely there, like, hey, we need to change the role of managers. And I think there's also some companies who actually do need it, but still are not yet aware that they want it. So we also don't want to waste too much time there and really focus on the companies that really see the need for it and use those innovators, you know, to take the lead.
Yeah, of course, it sounds very logical. And the challenging part is to find the right mindset, people at the right time, right? That's who really understand that, okay, soft skills, how we tend to call them, human-centered skills. I really love that, to change soft skills into human-centered skills. So can you, human-centered skills are making people feel seen, heard, what did you mention?
Valued. But it also, like sometimes if I have this conversation with certain people, they're like, yeah, but you cannot be too soft for people. I'm like, that's the opposite of what we say. We never say be too soft, but you cannot be too humane. You cannot be too human. But that, for example, if you raise your child, you have three children. So if you raise your children, you know you cannot give too much love, but you can give too little boundaries. Right? And I think I never want to make the parallel between family and company because it's completely different. But in this sense, I think leadership is the same. It doesn't mean you have to be less human to lead other people, but human-centered skill means, hey, in the container, in the foundation you build, you can be as human as possible, but with like very clear boundaries, with super clear boundaries, with super clear expectation management. And you know, like, this is part of human-centered skills. So I'm just saying this out because I heard this a lot, like, hey, yeah, we're gonna be too soft. That's the opposite of what we mean.
And when are you happy? When can you say my company is doing well?
That's a conversation we have a lot. And actually I found it was really interesting to that I've spoken to another founder very recently that thought about it the same, because we thought we are kind of alone in this sense. We live in a capitalist world, obviously, and everything is about growth, revenue, etc., etc. And I do believe that we need to be very financially healthy, obviously, to grow, to have more impact. But at the same time, our belief was always like, hey, if we get to a certain point that we sell incredibly well, but we see just that our adoption rate is not super high and the impact is not super high, because we can measure the impact by asking feedback indirectly and directly about how good a leadership is. If we see that there's not much progress, that's not something we could be very proud of. So for us, it's yes, we need to grow. Yes, we need to, I think that's obvious that we need these things. But for us, the most important thing is, do we see that there's high adoption? Because in B2B, especially in the HR L&D, it's not super sexy. It's not like B2C. Like in B2C, if you would have an app, you would pay €5. If it doesn't like satisfy you for at least 80%, you will cancel it like today. With B2B, it doesn't work like that. If you sell, if your company can be like, oh yeah, we're greenwashing, we're people washing, you know, like just be like, look, we are doing
ticking
something.
Ticking the boxes.
Ticking the boxes. Sometimes you can have like a 3-year contract by taking, obviously you need to have some value, but I mean like without having actual impact, you can still manage and still grow. And that's not our goal. Our goal is to truly see how can we get a lot of adoption? How can we get this B2C mentality of tooling into the B2B world and to really have ambassadors from bottom up, really have managers are saying, hey, this tool is amazing. That if your company wants to stop there, they're like, hey, like either I'm, you know, like I'm going to change company, I'm going to pay it for myself. Like there's some resistance of stopping it. That's our ideal goal, to have so much impact.
And that makes me really curious about, and I believe the listeners, of course, also is, why is this of importance of you yourself?
I think whatever I've done, I'm really happy with my upbringing, because whatever I've done, I always thought like, what is my impact? I studied business and then I didn't care too much about the study besides the leadership and culture part, which I truly loved. All my theses were always about those topics. And then I did my master's in entrepreneurship. Same reason, I thought like entrepreneurship is a way easier way to have impact. So then when I did my background was, and I saw a lot of people in my environment, their parents were thinking like, hey, what are you becoming? Like, are you becoming doctor, engineer? I think a lot of people with migration background have this pressure on them. Like you have to get like this big degree and like get this super high status job, which is great. Obviously we need these people. But for me, my upbringing was like, okay, if you finish your study, I did get a pressure for the study, but besides that, it was like, like the study, yes.
For sure. A study.
Yeah. A study. But then afterwards, it was like, okay, how are you going to add value? Do something you love, and how are you going to add value? So adding value and having impact is not something that I do because it's like, you know, getting famous nowadays. It's just something that I don't even know how to, like what to do else, because having value, we're all part of this community. We're all going through this human experience. You know, like we are not individuals. There's an illusion that there's no individualism in humanity, that we're all part of this spider web, super intertwined, connected. And we all have our role, but sometimes you're less aware of it. And I always try to, you know, find my own way to have impact. And I think tooling and tech, I actually, to be honest, that's also something I really want to confess. It's very hard.
Like, what do you mean by heart?
It's before we started, we're like, yeah, we're going to build a tool. We're going to have impact. Da, 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 da. But then we realized like, yeah, it's much harder than you think. Tech is cool. And obviously, if you have like a very good product market fit and you get there, blah, blah, you can get a lot of impact. But at the same time, it remains a tool, right? So it's not like mind-blowing changing what you, for example, can have at a retreat or like at beautiful in-person trainings or being a nurse or, you know, being a doctor, or like to have actual direct impact. I think it's much harder with tooling, but we still want to accept the challenge to see if we can have some kind of positive impact on people.
Yeah, at least also an attempt to scale it at a broader, at a wide scale, right? Yeah. To reach many, many people, because I believe that's what's driving you also, impact on scale, at scale.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. Cool. And you mentioned upbringing. Can you, because it's obviously the podcast is about journeys of empowerment, and I'm really curious about your upbringing. Can you tell us share us a little bit more? How did you grow up?
Of course. It was a pretty different story, I think, than the traditional story, as in I was born in Kurdistan with my parents. We stayed there until I was three. And that was the moment, I think it was especially my mom, that thought, okay, this is, it was in the wartime, it was in the 90s, there was extremely poverty, people were not getting fed. And my mom truly said, okay, I have some family in Sweden and in Netherlands, and she said, they're living there, they're having a good life already. They actually were not refugees, they already went there in the 70s, 80s. And they told her with the little communication tools possible at that time, like, hey, come here, there's possibility for you guys. So that's the moment we decided to leave. But then the interesting part is usually people, at least that's what I, the people I spoke to, they have this assumption that if you are a refugee and you leave, you can like reach a country in maybe 1 or 2 weeks and that's it. But in our case, it took 3 years. So we left when we were three. Then we went to Turkey. And then there was this Sufi, like it was a long way to get there near Istanbul. And that was this Sufi guy. I don't know if you know the religion of Sufi. It's like what Rumi also has. It's this religion within Islam. But it's like for them, I think God is like love. It's a beautiful, beautiful philosophy. And this guy, he was also Kurdish. And while Turkish and Kurdish thing is like super sensitive, like a lot of times there's this, you know, whole bias towards each other and they think they're tension. Terrorists. And yeah, there's a lot of tension. But this guy had so much respect, even from the local authorities, that he had a huge, like a really big kind of mansion and stuff. And there was a lot of refugees always staying there, Kurdish refugees. They were on the way. The Turkish military, the police, everybody knew it, but it was like an embassy. It was like there's no touch zone, which was beautiful. So I think my parents were able to stay there like 1.5 year to save up some money and knowledge, because back then you had no Google. So basically knowledge was just like word of mouth, and you need to collect like knowledge at how to move forward. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Greece, and I think that road was probably, the reason I'm so detailed about now, last weekend, my uncle was visiting, so we were all sitting at home, we were having beautiful conversation, and we spoke more about the details, and it was insane to hear what they have been gone through, because I've been gone through it as well, but I was 4 at this time, and then it took them like a few weeks on the road in the night, at night, to cross the border from Turkey to Greece, then to arrive in Greece. A lot of things happened there, and but at the same time, I think even when we arrived in Greece, we had to stay there also 1.5 year in like this super little room with all of us until my parents had enough money to collect. And then we again like took a whole road to get to the Netherlands. But I think for them, it was insane to have, because I just became a father. I cannot even imagine how this must have been. But for me, I was just 4 and then I became 5. And I had this incredibly loving parents, you know, they always were there for me, even though we had nothing, they were there for me. And there was this unconditional love that I think I felt. And I'm sure it also gave me a lot of traumas that I'm perhaps not aware of. But at the same time, when I think of my childhood, I don't know, it's a beautiful childhood. Because even when we arrived in Netherlands and we went to those refugee camps, etc., and then we got this housing, I think in the first few years, we barely had like a couch and, you know, like it was financial, I could say definitely poverty, but I could never say that I was poor. As in the amount of love, the amount of unconditional support I got. I remember even as being a child, being like living in such a financial poor house, all the time when children were playing in my house, they were like, man, like, can I come next week? Can I come next week? Because they came, and then my mother was like, hey, who wants hamburger? You get hamburger. You get hamburger. You know, like people were like, they were always like so happy about seeing this vibe at our house, that everybody kind of, you know, respected each other, loved each other. We played game. We could do whatever we want. There were no strict, super strict rules. And I think obviously as children, we love a house with not too strict rules. So that's a bit more into detail about the very young childhood that I had.
And how old were you from Greece to the Netherlands? Eh? So the trip went from Turkey to Greece and Greece to the Netherlands straight away, or?
No, I think that part also took a few weeks, but that's, I like Italy somewhere. I even remember having red hair, because like they wanted to, I think we got like Dutch IDs or something through someone. That's how it went back in the day. And then we had to pretend we're Dutch. Like, you know, like my hair color is like super black. So they try to make this blonde, but then you don't get blonde. You get like weird reddish. And then we were like standing in front of this container ship. I remember I was like,
I laugh, but it's painfully, but it's also funny.
It's now it's funny. Like I remember I was shitting my pants at this moment, be like, because they told me like, if we get caught, we are going to send back. So we were standing there like, please don't find out, please. And then we got in, and then we moved to Italy, I think. And from there, it took a few weeks. And then we were here, and we had family to kind of show us around. And but at the same time, I think it was beautiful to see how my parents kind of adopted here, how they their perspective on world, how incredibly optimistic, especially my mom, like always seeing the beauty in everything. I think the movie of La Vita Bella, you know, the famous Italian movie, obviously is very different. I will definitely not compare myself to this, but the fact that this father could be so optimistic and like spark the fantasy of his child, I think this kind of really resembles what I've been through. Like, even though we were refugees, even though we have seen like horrible things on the way here, there was always this sparking of my fantasy, allowing me to stay a child, you know, allowing me to see the beauty and stuff. That's the reason I think that I still look back and be like, yeah, I really love my childhood. And yeah, and everyone has his ups and downs and their challenges. But on overall, I have a very warm feeling thinking back of being supported.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And I think if your mother is listening to this, she can only be proud, right? Because going through so much challenge, also adversity, uncertainty, setbacks, and then your son, hearing your son later in the podcast saying, although we went through a lot, I felt, and I'm looking back at a great youth and upbringing, I think it's beautiful. It's the only word I have for now. Because when you look to other parents here in the Netherlands, and sometimes I think, why are we all creating these problems and having such, we have all everything in place what can help us solve every problem we face, and we create problems. And you went with your family to a lot of challenges and still coming out so positive and positive without denying where we came from, right?
100%. I don't think in this toxic positivity it's like everything is positive. No, it was more about like, yes, there is a lot of things going on. There's a lot of sadness going on in the world. There's a lot of like horrible things going on. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's also about once you go through those things, it's kind of also what Viktor Frankl said in the, you know, in like Man's Search for Meaning.
Yeah.
It's about like, where do you focus on? It's not about neglecting the other thing, because they're definitely there and they definitely need their acknowledgement as well. But it's also like your story in your own mind. Like, if you keep on focusing on all the beautiful things that life has to offer, you know, and also in people, like, I think that was also one of the lessons I got at a very young age, is when we had this, like, I think very traumatized ex-Nazi military neighbor. I think he was very old. He was living there. He was kind of hiding. At least that was the rumor, because nobody literally spoke to him. But one day he was like super mad. I cannot remember the exact details, whether it was with my brother, I think so. But and then he was like yelling at the street for no reason, because he was just playing football. And I remember I was so angry. I wanted to go to him, like I was like teenagers. I wanted to shout, be like, hey, you know, what's up? Why are you doing that? But then my mom, I remember, told me like, hey, why would you get mad at this man? I was like, yeah, but he cannot shout at a little kid. But he was like, just imagine you're such an old man and you shout for playing football at a young child. What type of trauma and pain must he go through? And it doesn't mean that I should not set boundaries. That's not what it means at all. It just meant that, hey, you can actually try to understand where things are coming from, even if you don't approve it. And I think that was a very core message at a very young age that I learned, and that I still would love to see more often in media, in bigger narratives. It's like, can we try to understand things that we don't approve? Because usually if we don't approve something, we also don't want to understand where it's coming from, because it feels like if we try to understand where it's coming from, we're approving it. But I completely disagree with that narrative, because we can try to understand, oh yeah, this is trauma, this is pain, set boundaries, but knowing where it comes from, you also take it less personal, because it's not you. They're going through pain. It's not you. You don't have to be the main, the Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie in every movie. You can also be a B role. You can be a C role. You know, you're not that important in a most positive sense, actually.
It sounds like you grew up with role models, right? Yeah. Your parents as role models for modeling your belief. This is a belief you really believe in. And we were, as we were, before we started our conversation, we went to the woods. We had some cake to celebrate the first anniversary of my company. And in the car back to our studio, home studio, you said you became very driven about not understanding why people can't separate it, right? Yep. Can you get back to that conversation a little bit and take us through what was happening also for you? Why there is something happening, because you are very grounded, very relaxed, very calm. And here I sensed that, hey, here is something happening also for you that's really, there's more tension inside you.
I think you've seen it definitely, right? And yeah, it kind of triggers me, as in, not as like in a big trigger, but it triggers me in a way that, for me, like I said, like human connection, try to understand people and see where people are coming from is such an important value that it feels like a type of ignorance, but like a type of, like, even a very unconscious ignorance, because it's not even that ignorant people are doing this. It's also the most educated, highly intelligent people. You hear it from all corners coming. Like, if something's happened, whether it's geopolitical, whether it's individual that does something, even whether it's a terrorist, like, it sounds really bad, but a lot of people, but like, sometimes you do have to understand people can have mental illnesses, people can be super, super easy manipulated by other people. And again, that doesn't mean you should not set boundaries, or you should approve it. Not at all. Opposite of it. However, if you try to understand, for example, with this type of thing, you also know, okay, this is where it comes from. So if we want to try to heal the root cause, we cannot say war on terrorism. Try to heal the pool where they are getting their candidates from. Because the people who are, for example, and this is like, I don't know how I got into this example, this is a very irrelevant example for this podcast, but just to as a metaphor, the places that they recruit their people, because the people who are coming with us, they never do anything themselves, they're recruiting. Where are they recruiting from? They're recruiting from people who don't feel like they belong. They're recruiting from places where they feel like they're being, you know, the evil has been done on them. There's so many variables. This is actually way too complex example that I'm giving. But at the same time, what I'm trying to say is, by trying to understand, you can also find the root cause. And when you know root causes of where things are coming from, you can build so much better solutions. You can connect so much better with other people, and we can step out of this narrative of bad and evil. When a fox eats a rabbit or kills a rabbit to feed his children, is it bad or is it good? It's what it does, right? Like, you try to understand where it's coming from. But when it's human, we always take this super personal. And I think, we definitely, as a society, as a big narrative, could use a bit more like, hey, where are things coming from? And I'm not saying that people are not doing this. There's amazing people in healthcare, in politics, everywhere they are there, but it's still the underdog. And I would love to have more of this. Where are things coming from? Even if we don't approve, try to understand it so we can, you know, like, prevent it better in the future.
Amen to that. Hey, and, if we look a little to your journey you've made, what helped you become you? You're the way I know you, and we got to know each other in a quite short time very well, is grounded and is, you do yoga, you do meditation. What helps you to also with the rush of the speed of the day, and what helps you to become you and to stay you, because you're so grounded? And I never notice anything about you when we are in stressy situations, or I can imagine being a startup founder, there's a lot of stress, maybe not an inside, but then the rest of startups, but team human AI. But what helps you?
I think going beyond the understanding, because there's a thing about like trying to read into mindfulness, trying to read in emotional awareness. And I think those things are 100% helpful because it's good. But I also feel a lot of times in this Western rational society, we try to state understanding. But for me, always like at a very young age, also having like, for example, a very spiritual mother who was very into emotional development, spiritual development, it felt supernatural to be more curious about it, to also try to experience it. So, for example, emotional regulation, if you truly use and whatever helps for you, because, for example, meditation and breath work and all those things at a very young age, being doing it actively and not, really helped for me. But I'm not saying that's the only way. It can be cooking. It can be whatever it is. But whatever works for you. But trying to find techniques that you can truly feel. Because nobody ever said think alive. It's feel alive, right? But that's what we forget. We are always all stuck in our head. We are so afraid to feel. And I think this whole pandemic with addiction to phones, etc., is also like a way to escape. Because if you would, for example, if you're like in an urge between two stops at a bus station, you always get a phone. But if you actually like would put it away, it also means that there's a chance you will be confronted with feeling what's inside. And feeling what's inside can also be, it can mean that you feel lonely, maybe and you don't want to, you know, be confronted. Maybe you feel sad, maybe you feel angry, frustrated, whatever. We find it so uncomfortable that we're always running away from it. So we're always finding these escapes to go. And even when we do yoga meditation, it can be a super good tool. But sometimes that can also be like, okay, I'm doing my meditation and then I go. But in the end, you do these tools to live well, right? You don't, the tools in itself are not a goal. They're just a tool. And it's not that I don't feel stressed because I just heard you. I don't know. I do feel everything. Actually, I think I feel way more than the average person who's running away from it. But I'm not identifying with my emotions or with my thoughts through this type of practices, because in a while you realize, wait a second. Oh, I feel sadness, for example. If you feel sadness, it just wants to be felt. And if you go through it, where do I feel it? And then you feel it. And even like physiologically, like a lot of emotions only take like 90 seconds as electric impulse go through your body. You know, usually the scary part is when we suppress them all and then there's a narrative with it and then suppress them. And one day it comes out, it feels like you have, but that's just a lot of emotions, you know, on each other. And I think that insight at a very young age that we are, it sounds super spiritual on a SaaS podcast, but that we are one. We are one, and not in a rational sense. We are one. What does it mean? I'm not one. You're sitting there. I'm sitting here. No, we are one as in we are just life trying to express itself through your body, through my body, through a cat, through a rabbit, through a tree. And we're all connected somehow. There's this collective consciousness. And the moment you can truly experience that, and it sounds super weird, I think, for a lot of, especially in Dutch German culture where we are like, you know, like very rational. But I think if you allow yourself to do more practices that help for you, whatever it may be, that you can get more in touch with it, with this essence. And I think the moment you get in touch with this, which we all have, which we're all part of, like there's no one who's more this than somebody else, it can really, really help you in being grounded and like feeling emotions and going through uncomfortable emotions, because like they will never stop. That is just the value and the meaning you give through them, the narrative. It's just different. It's like, oh yeah, it's just an emotion and it wants to be felt. You cannot discriminate between your emotions. So you either feel them all.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also, like, I cry of gratitude every week. Just not from something that happened. Just looking outside, drinking my coffee, looking at my child, looking at my partner, thinking about my friends, thinking about my family. Just looking outside and I just cry of gratitude. Why? Because I have all reasons, just like you. But that's a thing I trained myself to get there, you know, to feel this. But if you want to feel this level of gratitude, you also have to at the same time accept that sometimes sadness will come up, loneliness will come up, and pretty intense as well, and just accept it. Because I think personally, if you try to suppress the bad side, you definitely will also suppress the good side.
Yeah, definitely. It works both ways. You block it out, or you tend to think that you're able to block it out. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's more accurate. Yeah. And in the end, it will pop up at an unforeseen timing and with severe more impact.
Because I've seen this in the last year, 1.5 year with you, going like seeing you being like, Michiel, going from here to there, like never having been able to stand next to you for more than 2 seconds, to be a very, like, you're so much more grounded. What has worked for you?
That's a good question. What helped for me, it is a process of multiple years going inward. And what really helped for me, it was the journey, the literal journey in preparation and the visit for the first time in my birth country, India, and birthplace, Mumbai, and specifically the orphanage where I've been given away as baby, 10 days old baby. And I felt so much groundedness, so much like, okay, I grew up in the Netherlands and partly in the US, but here is my starting point. And I felt for the first time also that I got three presents from my birth mother, and that is life in and of itself, obviously. Her life force, I feel that from deep within, her life force, and the opportunity for a better life by giving me away as 10 days old baby. And realizing that there is a starting point there, also without knowing exactly my starting point, there is a place where it's all started. I've visited there, I've been there, I've smelled it, I've spoken with the nurses, that it was beautiful. That experience really helped me to realize there is a place where I grew up and there is a place where it started. And in both places, I feel a sense of belonging. And I never felt excluded in the Netherlands, luckily, on the one hand, but on the other hand, deep down, it's obvious all the genetic markers aren't from here. So going back to India for the first time, it took me 48 years, 49 years, that says also something, right? I was really afraid of the impact and if I'm ready enough and what will it do. Luckily, I did. But realizing, hey, there is a place in the world where it started, that's partly you, and there's a place in the world where you grew up, and there's a place in the world. And knowing that there is a place, that alone already gave me a feeling like, yeah, groundedness. So those two pieces together formed like, okay, I feel myself 100% Dutch with Indian roots. And the whole feeling of having roots, being rooted, being grounded, literally landed from within, that helped me most. And the love of my children, the friendships, the beautiful things I'm allowed to do, starting a podcast, bit scary, but doing it anyway, embracing discomfort, hearing yourself to your headphone and knowing I'm not the guest, but I'm now the host. But being that, what helped me is really allowing myself to accept myself in my whole being instead of being one part of the being growing up here. I think that other part missed. It was partly unconscious, also not aware about separation trauma and all the effects about it, but because I was a baby, my story was always, yeah, I was 6 months old when I came to the Netherlands. What kind of collateral damage can you have? Yeah, that's too easy. But allowing my feelings, my thoughts, that helped me the most. And being surrounded with beautiful people, friends, chosen who become my chosen family, my daughters, my beautiful daughters, the love of my life. So long answer, sorry, but this is my answer to your question. It all adds up. But if I have to pinpoint one thing, was the visit for the first time in India. And in 2025, I'm planning to go two times, at least two times. Mm-hmm. And so we're establishing a foundation, the Sujit Foundation. So my first name was, of my second name now, was first my first name when given away as baby. It means auspicious victory. So I thought, that's pretty okay name for a foundation. And we're going to focus on quality education and health and good health and well-being. And starting point is obviously the St. Joseph home where I've been given away as baby. And being able and to allow myself to feel, because there, you, as you can imagine, a lot of feelings arise within myself talking about this. It feels enriching, enlightening. It feels relieving. So thank you for your question. And a little bit long answer, but going inward and allowing all the feelings where I was afraid of. I think that's, yeah.
I really appreciate your answer. And also I heard allowing myself a few times and I think that really resonates.
Yeah, yeah. It's about allowing. And when you talk about that really resonates with me personally, when you talk about allowing your feelings, happiness, but also sadness, and you mentioned also loneliness, what do you have specific memories when you think or feel, it's not about thinking, it's about feeling loneliness, or what comes up when you are lonely and you're allowing your feelings about loneliness?
I think for me, in the recent years, when I felt loneliness, it really felt like an old emotion. As in, through day life, I didn't feel it that much. I felt a lot of other uncomfortable emotions. But a lot of times I did this, like, you know, going inward, trying to go into a deeper meditative level, write, journal, think about certain times. And then at certain ages, I think, especially when we're younger, you're so much on the move, obviously you feel loneliness. I think even when I was, my parents tell the story that when I was 4 in Greece, that they really didn't have the means to like stay around, and they had to work. So I had to stay at home by myself at 4. And that after a while, I was so mad at them that they barely had money to buy sugar. But what I did, I combined the sugar with the salt just to, you know, like take revenge on them. And they knew, like, you can never like separate those two from each other. But I think that perhaps might have led a lot of these type of emotions, you know, being young, having to stay alone at home. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the, when you said allowing yourself, what really resonated with myself is in these last 15 years of, you know, going to personal development, self-inquiry, etc. I really felt like, hey, what is the narrative you have with yourself? So just imagine, you have shared a lot of stories about your life. Just imagine every time you shared like the challenges you had, I would be like, Michiel, you suck. Michiel, you are the worst boyfriend. Michiel, to be honest, I don't think there's a worse father than you are. Michiel, you look fat. You know, if I would say all these things, I'm sure like you would not allow me maybe one or two times. And then you're like, hey, Farzan, like, can you please leave, right?
Well, I would say when it comes from your mouth, I think it's a compliment or it's jealousy. I don't know.
No, but like, on all serious note, like you would, like if somebody else would say it, you will not allow it. But here's the interesting part. We do it with ourselves all the time. So that's what I love when you say allowing yourself. I also like, how many of us allow ourselves to treat ourselves like we would treat our best friend? Mm. If we fail, for example, and that's also some part of Team Human, like in the self-compassion is one of the most important skills also in positive psychology, because we have this belief a lot of times, especially with career, with goal setting, that we have this strict father, mother with sports. Yeah, you have to be good. And then you get this 9 and they're like, yeah, I'm not, you should get a 10, you know? And then you ask the father, why do you say this? Yeah, if I tell him that I'm proud, he will not want to go further. And all research shows that this BS, this is not true. So the higher self-compassion you have, which is the narrative, you how you talk to yourself, actually correlated with way more like courage to go out of your boundaries, to be way more ambitious. Why? Because you can put your ambition goals way higher. Because if you fail, you're not afraid. You're going to be kind enough anyways. You're going to tell yourself, you know what? You're okay to fail. You at least tried your best. So that's the narrative that is very counterintuitive for a lot of people in these societies where, you know, being hard on yourself to succeed. But I think it's not only applicable in leadership and in sports, etc. I think it's personally for me one of the skills that I appreciate most of having developed and still developing is this self-compassion about how mindful are you about the fact that you have thoughts, you know, like that's step one. Mm-hmm. Step two is, how kind are you speaking to yourself? What is the narrative? When I fail, do you say, Farzan, you're terrible, you're the worst? Or do you actually see this thought popping up because you cannot control it? And then change the narrative, you know, it's okay. You're okay to have a hard time. You know what? It's okay that you are not accepting this. That's also okay. You know, that there's just some space of acceptance. And the third aspect of self-compassion, and that's the one, you know, from my workshops, I think this is maybe the theme I will end like the last chapter, full chapters of my life with, and that's common humanity. Mm. And common humanity means the ability of knowing that other people are going through the same human experience. And I once had, like many years ago, this course by, I think it was this mindfulness and neuroscience course by Google and some other company. And there was this neuroscientist woman, and she really inspired me to the day of today, also with the level of vulnerability, but as a strength in front of the class. And then she told me the story that she had had 4 miscarriages. And then the 5th time she got pregnant, she got her son. He was 2. But then, and this woman, don't get me wrong, she's doing mindfulness for like, she's like meditating for like 20 years. She's gone to every Vipassana. She has done everything on the level of like this type of meditative things. But still, she was suffering from insomnia. That's the thing that you cannot sleep or like very hard to sleep. Why? Because every time that she fell asleep, she dreamt that her actual child would die of like a miscarriage. So this hurt her. But then she shared the story and everybody in the audience was already like, holy, like, are you know, like we got goosebumps and it felt super. But then she did this beautiful thing. Like this, that's a moment I said, a common humanity is going to be a thing that I'm going to, you know, like truly, truly find out more about in organized workshops or Amal, is she said, but at the same time, I'm from Berlin. I lay there, I close my eyes, and then I visualize Berlin. And then I see a light popping up in this street, a light popping up in this street, a light popping up in this street. And I see hundreds of them, thousands of them, with all other mothers that have insomnia at this specific moment. And she said, you don't use this to be like, oh, other people are hurting, so that makes me feel good. No, no. It's about this sense of common humanity. Be like, wow, I'm not the only one. Because that's the thing. Rationally, we know. But emotionally, every time we fail, we think we are unique. And I think being able to show common humanity, and I think that's why I love the word, the name Team Human. We're all part of Team Human. And you being, I don't know, anti-refugees and hating refugees, and you being a refugee, putting these two people in front of each other, you would think that they would have all reason to fight, etc. But I believe if you facilitate this in the right context, these two people, and asking the right questions, making them have the right dialogue, they will actually find out that they maybe have so much more in common with each other than with all other people that are not even in their polarized standpoint. That they maybe, if they don't even know each other's standpoint first and actually have these conversations about their own stories from their youth, what they find important, their values, why they find these values so important, maybe perhaps doing the exercise I did with the eye gazing connection, knowing like having this guided speech about like, hey, they're going through pain, I go through pain, they want to be happy, I want to be happy. So doing all these things, that in the end, it's just an illusion. Like, yes, there are differences. Obviously, I'm not saying we don't have, but the degree that we think we have differences is an illusion, because we have so much more commonality, so much more than different differences. They are there, and actually I love them. Also with parenting, like we just became a parent. You see every, yeah, you should do this child. I'm like, you do you, you know, like just make sure, you know, your child gets some love, some attention, some, you know, like non-traumatic stuff. But then in the same time, they don't have to be the same, because that creates beauty in society. We create different people, you know, if the foundation is good. We don't have to be the same, all of us.
Beautiful, common humanity. Yeah, I often say, although we are unique or the situation is unique when you look really into the detailed specifics, yet there is much more which is common, and we don't have to be alone. So we can be unique, but not feeling alone.
100%.
You know, every divorce is different. But opening up with other people who are in the same situation with different specifics, the whole feeling about being able to share and to talk about it and make you understand that that was for me also an eye-opener, because I never went deep into the whole adoption scene, adoption people. I didn't know many, maybe three or four before my whole research started. Let's go to India. Let's prepare. So what can we find? And maybe it's good to reach out to one or two adopted from India and who went already back to their country. And then all of a sudden I became involved in a platform that's now called INEA, Interlandelijke Adoption. So international adopted children growing up in the Netherlands. And I saw many from many different angles of the world adopted, not anymore children, of course, and I spoke to many, and we share the same common kind of wound, although the wound what I'm talking about specifically is separation trauma. So when you got separated within the first 12 months of as a baby, that has a severe impact for the rest of your life, but it is in your implicit memory. You're not conscious about it, but all your thoughts, behaviors, your feelings, your bodily reaction to something what happens, which you aren't aware of, but you feel it. It's there, it's inside you. And hearing about that and reading a book about it, Primal Wounds, and it made me feel, I thought really I'm the only one in the world, right? And I love the common humanity to bring it together, to talk about it, to open up about it, and to create more common language and common ground, but also common language, and to find language to bring it out, to say it. And so for me personally, that was the book Primal Wound. And I was really surprised. 95% of the book resonated so hard that I thought, this book is about me. And for the first time, I really felt seen, heard, appreciated, understood by a book. Literally written three decades ago, 1993. I read it in 2023, 2022 maybe. Yeah, so a common humanity, beautiful. And do you see a role for your company in that, or do you see a personal role, or maybe together? How do you envision being able to do that for the rest of your life? How do you envision that?
First of all, thank you for sharing. I think this is a beautiful illustration of showing the point of common humanity. And for your question, I think both. In Team Human, we in the end want to go to this place that we become the coach of every manager that really helps them with guiding this. So helps them with finding mental health issues, helps them with finding whether somebody's not feeling included, and truly helps them how to solve this. So on the one hand, the tool. But on the other hand, me as a person, I don't think this will be something that stops at a tool or will stop in with the exit of a tool or whatever. This is something I think I will continue for whatever foreseeable future. And one of my dreams that I actually have is to make a short documentary that truly illustrates this. So I actually want, I don't know exactly the form because I'm not a documentary maker. I want to find somebody that truly resonates on the same level. But more in the background of it, to create this documentary that truly shows what we just discussed, but then made visual for people. So for example, if we can in this documentary can find what the example I just gave, somebody who for example has hate for refugees and maybe find a refugee, somebody that is super afraid or hates transphobic and find somebody who actually went through a sex change, finding all this type of polarized type of subjects in society, don't tell them about each other that you know this, and actually also ask them questions to share about their things, and then in the end put them together in this type of workshop, really film the faces once this connection is made. Because I think that's my dream, to showcase to the world if they can do it, and I 100% believe that if we do it in the right way, we can build connection through all these people, that if they can do it, who are we who are not in such polarized positions, perhaps it cannot do it. And there was actually this even beautiful example at least very painful and beautiful example of this two fathers, one Israeli and one Palestinian, that both lost their daughter. I think one of them lost their daughter through an attack by Hamas, and the other one lost their daughter by attack by the Israeli forces. So both of them lost a daughter to the like enemy, quote unquote, but actually found each other, these fathers. They found each other through the pain. They said, whatever happened, we have exactly the same pain. Even though this is a horrible example, it truly showed me as well the power of common humanity, because they were like, yes, there's a narrative, you are this and I'm this label, you're this label, and political powers who have also like double agendas, etc., etc. But in the end, we as humans, we're just humans. We're going through the same, we have the same needs, we want to be seen, we want to be valued, we want to be heard, you know. And these things can, you know, like really bond people. So in the end, I really want to get to a point that I can build such a beautiful documentary that really has impact and really can show this polarized political parties like, hey, it's not as black and white as you think. And before that, I think in the coming years, I'm really keen on developing my workshops on these topics even further. And doing this next to my startup, because I really think they're complementary. Like,
yeah, it's complementary, and it doesn't need an either or, right?
Exactly.
There is a component tech in what can help you on the other side in your workshops. There is some combination thinkable, right?
At least the visions are very, very complementary. And I think how to do it in practically, operationally, that's something I have to find out in the coming years. But I'm already starting the workshops again, and I feel like there's a lot of need for it. Like, you know it, we know it. There's what I also said earlier. I think there's a lot of beautiful initiatives lately in the last maybe 10 years on the level of self-connection. So there's just all these beautiful retreats, and there's this yoga classes, and there's meditation. There's so much going on the way of, hey, how to connect with ourselves, how to find out what our emotions are. There's so many good therapy sessions. So therapy is becoming less of taboo. I think that part is going incredibly well, as in like how much momentum it gets. It can always get more, obviously. But on the part of connecting with each other, to be honest, I think that actually goes backward. Because even though we know we should connect with others, but in reality, how many people do you talk with in your daily life that have a complete different political view than you? How many people do you talk with in your life that have complete different views on certain topics? You actually don't even come in touch with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a pretty big danger, because we live in the same society. You don't have to hang out with people with different views all the time. But there's almost no common ground anymore where we meet each other, where we actually found out like, hey, wait a second, they're human, we are human. We don't have to believe the narrative the algorithms are telling us that bring us to this loop of self-confirmation, of telling, hey, if we believe that everyone is green, that is good, and everyone is red is bad, then these algorithms will only give you more proof, you know? So I really believe that this connecting with others, this domain really, really can get way more initiatives.
I think we need at least a few podcasts to go deeper and deeper into common humanity and what it can bring and how it can help us. And for now, I have one question, and it's a little bit far from where we're talking about, but I know there is something happening inside you and also obviously observable when you talk about your fathership. So you're a proud father.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit, how old is your tell us, because that's the whole smile. And the second question I have is, what helps you from your upbringing in your upbringing for him?
Hmm. Yeah, Nali, that's my little son. I think he's 1 year and 8 months. At least he's more than 1 and 8 months. I get a smile if I think about him. I get a smile when I wake up. I get a smile when I go home. I think I was already a very, very happy man, but this little dude is like, you're on, I don't know, like on this endorphin, whatever, dopamine, serotonin kick the whole time. So basically I'm super, super, super in love with him. And yeah, what I bring from my own upbringing, I think what the most important thing that I want to copy paste is unconditional love. And my partner, actually, we spoke a lot with her about it as well. And she is, it's opening up a whole new world for her to come into my family all the time when we have dinners there, that we can, like, yes, you know, like, you can walk in at a certain time and then it's okay. You can do certain, you can be, say, hey, I'm tired, where there's a family dinner, go to other room. It's okay. It's not like it's okay as in, yes, you can do this, but they don't like it. No, it's all okay. Like, there's so much unconditional support for each other, like, to the highest degree. Like, it's all okay. If you want to be picked up in the middle of night at 10, they will be there. They will pick you up. There's no, they will pick you up because they're like, you would only ask me if you need it. So you need it, I'm there. And that sometimes people are like, oh, you're spoiled. It doesn't work that way. Because the thing is, when my mom got diagnosed with breast cancer, the person who brought her every Friday to the hospital was me. And that's not like to look at me. No, it's actually, it shows this type of unconditional support. Once you get it, you completely get it back. It's this, I take care of you in my way, you take care of me in your way. And that's, you know, that's just, and I think what my partner really made me realize that that's something different, like that's unique in some cases, because I always thought this is how it works.
I luckily you feel that way, but I can I know more there are more examples. I get a little bit emotional now, but I know there are more examples that it's all conditional than unconditional. So wow, so copy paste unconditional love.
And I'm sure that's the thing also, trying to do it perfect, that's also this whole narrative we put on ourselves. I'm 100% sure there will be so many things later on, oh, I should have done different, but I'm super kind for myself because I know there's no parent that can do it perfectly, and that is okay. That's completely okay. Be kind for yourself during the journey, whatever. Like, I think Gabor Mate was saying that there's two things super important. One, be super happy yourself, take care of your own happiness, because they're egocentric. They think, hey, if you're unhappy, it's because of me. But if you're happy, it's because of me. And the other one is be there. Be there, spend time. And I'm sure I will learn a lot of things that I will do differently, but that's okay.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And hopefully we will have many more, because I think we can learn a lot about about your worldview, I believe. And also your positivity. And for me, the personal takeaways are common humanity. And of course, for me, knowing you, they are not new. Mm-hmm. But again, I discover some new depth in it. And the copy-paste unconditional love, I would love to scale that on a broader. So thank you very much. And
thank you, Maxime.
For you being you. Oh, and one more thing, a quarterly foundation allyship shout out. This quarter, I'm honored to spotlight Fresh Table Foundation, a true pioneer in social impact. Fresh Table is changing the world one meal at a time, empowering former refugees, promoting sustainability and advancing social inclusion through its work. Their vision of an inclusive, equal and sustainable world aligns beautifully with the mission here at Journeys of Empowerment. Join Fresh Table's mission to make an impact. To learn more and support their groundbreaking initiatives, visit freshtablefoundation.nl today. Together, we can make an impact and a difference, meal by meal.